702 on 92.7 and 106 FM. Streaming on 702.co.za.
The 702 app.
And on DStv channel 856.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa CIB. To gain data-driven insights on consumer behavior in African markets, tune into the Absa Insights Series podcast. That's Africanacity. Absa is an authorized FSP. Good evening and welcome to The Money Show. My name is Mateo Khwaribe. While filling up your grocery trolley will be even more expensive towards the holiday season, Stats SA today announcing that the country's consumer price index picked up slightly in October, rising to 7.6% from 7.5% in September. The budget eating items include bread, meat and dairy. So we'll have to keep in mind ahead of the Christmas shopping season. We'll talk about this and how it will affect consumers Peter Worthington, the senior economist at Absa. He'll also give us information about how this is likely to affect the SARB's decision tomorrow on interest rates. Now, while ordinary South Africans are trying to survive, government is still falling short of its goals of spending money to deliver services to citizens. This afternoon, the Auditor General releasing a report on its audit of national and provincial offices. And as usual, billions of rands are still going to waste. We'll get the full picture with the Auditor General, Tsakani Maluleke, shortly. The heavy results week continues, and it was Telkom's turn today. The telecoms company, currently being courted by various interested players, reported that headline earnings were down more than 50% for the 6 months ending in September. The partly state-owned telecoms firm says operating revenue was also down, but its prepaid subscriber base grew by 10% to more than 15 million. So we'll be talking to Group CEO at Telkom, Serame Taukubung. We'll take us through the numbers there. Our shapeshifter tonight is globally celebrated businesswoman and humanitarian Amanda Dambuza, so you'll want to stick around for that conversation. That's all and more on The Money Show.
702. Let's walk the talk.
Streaming countrywide on the 702 app.
Now, government has lost 12 billion rand due to fraud and non-compliance since 2019, while key departments such as health and education remain among the worst performing. But there were some positives and improvements. Auditor General Tsakani Maluleke tabled the audit report for the 2021-2022 financial year today and is joining us more for these numbers. AG, welcome to The Money Show.
Thank you very much, Mateo. Good evening to you and to your listeners. Thank you for having me.
Good evening. Well, 12 billion rand in losses over this audit period. Can we start with the national departments? Which ones are still lagging behind? And are you picking up any patterns there when it comes to material irregularities?
Thanks. So what we found is that the smaller departments and entities are doing well in terms of at least meeting the clean audit definition. They can report on their finances appropriately. They can report on their performance in a way that allows for transparency and for accountability to happen. And they operate within the rule of law, especially insofar as procurement is concerned. The bigger departments, the ones with the bigger budgets, tend not to. And that's a norm across most provinces, where you find that even if there are improvements in the number of clean audits, when you look at the quality of it, you realize that the budget, the large part of the budget, still sits in the hands of departments that cannot account appropriately for how they manage financial resources. They're not managing their performance appropriately, let alone report on it. And they also are still falling foul of the rule of law, especially in the area of procurement.
And why does the non-compliance persist then? Is it because of corruption amongst public office bearers, or is it a matter of not having the correct skilled personnel in the right positions?
Well, you know, a combination of normal audits as well as our material irregularities points to a couple of things. Yes, there are instances where there is clearly an intention to defraud and to cause leakage, and those are the matters that ultimately end up in the hands of the law enforcement agencies. There are instances where it's a case of a lack of skills, a case of a lack of control and monitoring. And when that happens, the environment then becomes susceptible to people actually creating leakage, right? There's a lack of oversight in terms of making sure that internal controls are observed and continually strengthened. So our view is that, yes, you've got to deal with wrongdoers and make sure that if somebody's done something wrong, the full might of the law follows, right? And that's what our MI process has been able to also assist in. But then you've also got to start setting a culture where internal controls are observed and you prevent problems in the very first instance. It's much cheaper to prevent a problem than to have to now spend money and significant time and effort chasing after a transaction that has been flagged by the Office of the AG. So the investment we all need to make is in creating a culture where you have the skills, you have the people in their roles, doing their work, being appropriately supervised and held accountable when they don't follow the things that have been set in place. And of course, when there are there's wrongdoing, intentional wrongdoing, there must also be consequences.
Well, AG, I mean, from your side and your officer's side, you clearly doing your job. But, you know, our government department saying, OK, last time you said you had recommendations for us and we weren't working well in this particular department. Can you help us? Can you hold our hand to make sure that next time when we report, we firstly give you all the documents you need, but also we don't have any wastage in terms of our spending? Are government departments approaching the office to make sure that they get better at reporting?
You know, few and far between. There are some that are being responsive, but if you look at the trends, it tells us that far too many are not being responsive to the normal audit or even to any other indicators of problems by internal audit or even audit committees. So what you've got to do is make sure that we've got accountable officers in place who are competent in their role, but also take it seriously, this notion of strengthening the accountability systems in government. If you're going to spend more time fighting one or other audit finding rather than understanding what would have caused the problem to begin with and close that door, it's going to be quite difficult to strengthen the institution and maintain the type of resources you need to deliver services in the long term and to make sure that you are efficient in the delivering of those services.
On the one hand, SARS is collecting more revenue from taxpayers and we're getting, you know, a surplus in terms of that. But on the other hand, there's still wastage on the from government. So, you know, how is this going to affect the fiscus? The fact that key departments like health and education are still the worst performing when it comes to these audit reports.
You know, the tragedy is that there are a number of officials in government who do a good job and who try and show up every single day and they do their very best. What we've got to do is invest in the type of disciplines and practices that make it possible for the ones who want to do good to do so effectively and consistently, and the ones who don't want to do good to be identified and to be dealt with appropriately. If we don't do that, we're going to continue to see leakage in the system. You're talking about the collection of revenue. You're also talking about the need for us to invest in infrastructure, for example, as part of growing the economy so that long term we've got the benefit of a thriving economy and a healthy fiscus. If we don't invest in the project management disciplines that allow us to ensure that all the projects we launch and fund have a high likelihood of being delivered on time, at the right price, and at the right quality, if we don't invest in those capabilities, the big budgets that we plan to put into infrastructure programs will not be implemented appropriately and we won't get the value we need. So our view is that it is high time that we invest in the skills, in the practices, and the disciplines that are necessary for infrastructure projects to be delivered properly.
All right, that was Sakani Maluleke, Auditor General of the Auditor General in South Africa. Well, she's telling us that a lot of government departments are not approaching the office to improve their position in terms of government spending. We saw government losing about 12 billion rand due to fraud and non-compliance since 2019, while key departments such as health and education remaining among the worst performing. So still concerning, even though there are some improvements.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
The heavy results week continuing on the market this week. Telecommunications group Telkom releasing its interim results for the 6 months ending September. The company's headline earnings down more than 50%. Basic earnings were also down 52.5%, lower by 131 cents per share. The group reported gross operating revenue marginally down at 21%. billion rand. The mobile business continued to drive growth in telecom consumer business. Total mobile revenue grew marginally by 0.5% as the product mix evolved towards longer postpaid contracts. Now, to join us for those particular numbers is Serame Taukubung, the Group CEO at Telkom. Serame, welcome to The Money Show.
Thank you, Mateo, and good evening to your listeners.
Well, the headlines saying it was a tough day for Telkom in terms of reporting these interim results. What was your view as a CEO over this particular period?
I think, Mateo, we have been operating under very challenging environments. I think we've talked about, you know, fuel increases and the impact on our customers. But that being said, I think we are encouraged by the fact that the investment in broadband and that the shape of our revenue is coming now from our next generation networks as opposed to legacy. So we'll continue the drive and focus of investing and realizing our ambitions to be a leader in broadband technologies in this country.
And let's talk about then your fixed line business. Are you going to be winding that off and then focusing on the broadband side and the Wi-Fi side of things as you go forward as Telkom?
That is a fact. So what is encouraging for us is that if we look at our OpenServe business, which is basically where we've had our fiber and traditional fixed line, now at least over 73% of our fixed line customers are sitting on fiber access, which is quite encouraging for us. We will continue to invest in one, homes passed, and also homes connected. On fiber, we're very encouraged with our homes connectivity ratio, sitting at 46.2%, which is the highest in the country. We will also continue to invest in gearing up for 5G because fiber is going to play a significant role in delivering 5G speeds to all our customers.
And, you know, the consumer situation is not likely to improve maybe until late next year. You know, what are some of the strategies that you're hoping to use to make sure that you get those numbers up again?
Absolutely. I think if you look at just our mobile business, in the first quarter of this year, we saw a decline in about 3.6%. We recovered well in the second half, ending the year flat. And I think this has been in response to the market. We have responded with competitive pricing, quite cognizant of the fact that our consumers are challenged. And we'll continue to make sure that we balance our cost of acquisition, but also continuing to drive revenue and value for money for our end users.
And is the company spending more then on trying to get their network stronger and more secure, especially with the load shedding that we've seen come from Eskom? We've seen the likes of MTN and Vodacom saying they are spending money on batteries and also diesel in terms of backup fuel for their batteries and infrastructure. Is it something Telkom is doing as well?
Absolutely. We are seeing these types of propositions carrying on for us. Our key business, Mota, are we still there?
I'm still here, loud and clear.
Thank you. For us, it's really to de-risk ourselves from exposure to diesel. I mean, in this period, we saw a 154% increase in diesel costs. We are looking at alternative power sources. We are looking at increasing our distribution of batteries so that we don't have a high reliance on diesel to make sure that our network runs efficiently despite the challenges that we're experiencing with load shedding.
And let's talk about those merger talks. We saw MTN announcing that they're walking away from a merger with Telkom, but do you still have a robust engagement with other parties that may be interested in the company?
We did also indicate to the market through our SENS that we had received a proposal from Rain. The team is busy engaging to look at what are the potential synergies of this conversation. We hope to be able to make a decision of go, no go by the end of December this year. As far as MTN is concerned, we still do have robust conversations with MTN. Last year, we signed a roaming agreement with MTN. MTN is actually our second biggest customer on our fiber network. And I think if you look at the high-level strategic direction, we still do feel that if MTN comes back, we can have a conversation.
All right, that was Serame Taukubung, the Group CEO at Telkom, saying the door is still open for MTN in terms of those merger talks. The telecommunications group, of course, releasing its interim results today for the 6 months ending in September. Company's headline earnings down more than 50%. Not the greatest of results, but in terms of outlook, Taukubung saying the group expects to grow at low to mid-single digit percentages in the medium term.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Well, it was a tough results day for telecoms company Telkom, as you've just heard from the group CEO there. And also the prices of goods and services are rising to 7.6% in October. Joining us to cut down all that market commentary is Chris Stewart, the portfolio manager at 91. Chris, let's start first with Naspers and Prosus. What sort of news came out of that results announcement?
Yeah, good evening, Mateo. We had interim results for the first half of the 2023 financial year out of Prosus. The Prosus Naspers stable today, and much was known already. I guess Tencent had already announced their results, and there had been some guidance to the market around Prosus and Naspers' earnings themselves. The news, I guess, that, you know, from a revenue perspective, probably a little light. From an earnings perspective, again, probably a little bit light, as the e-commerce ventures outside of that core Tencent holding continue to burn cash. So, from that perspective, possibly slightly negative at the margin. There was also some currency effects at play, with the strong dollar obviously negatively impacting if you are indeed earning revenues in currencies outside of the dollar. But in addition to that, they have indicated that they, you know, have put a firm target for profitability out for the consolidated e-commerce businesses outside of that Tencent holding for the first half of their 2025 financial year. So talking to scaling up some of the e-commerce businesses that they believe have runway to profitability, focusing on cost efficiencies, disposing of those that they believe don't have runway to profitability, and alluding to a more rational environment in the e-commerce space, I guess, as the easy money of the last many, many years starts to dry up. So hopefully they'll provide some more information around that at their Capital Markets Day coming up on the 6th of December. But the discipline of putting a line in the sand as to the date by which that portfolio will indeed be profitable, I think, positively received by the market. Also indicating that some of the unbundled shares, the Meituan shares that they will be receiving from Tencent, worth just over $5 billion, have been earmarked as held for sale. So if you add that to their existing cash pile of $1.5 billion after the iFood purchase that they've got coming up, there's another $6.5 billion of free cash, which, given that they have indicated many, many times that they are antagonized by the discount at net asset value to net asset value at which they trade, probably fairly significant liquidity to fund further buybacks and hopefully to close that discount to net asset value. So I guess those were probably the two key positives to take out of this.
And results. I'm sure it's a share that investors won't turn their back on. Naspers saying the worst is behind them. I'm sure that will hold them in good stead. But Telkom coming through with some very poor results. I just spoke to the CEO now. I'm not sure if you heard him earlier on, saying in the medium term, they expect the revenue to grow at low to mid single digit percentages. As a person who's trying to get into a merger with Telkom, are you looking at these results and saying we running as fast as we can, or are you still interested in the business?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that it seems as though Telkom is a difficult business to deal with from a potential corporate action perspective. But nonetheless, if you look at the results, as you indicate, fairly disappointing. Earnings towards the lower end of the pre-guided range, down 52-odd%. Even though the second quarter looks like it was very slightly better than the first quarter. And the medium-term guidance, as you indicate, low to mid-single-digit growth in revenue and EBITDA is a downgrade on the previous sort of medium-term guidance that they've given. Add to that negative free cash flow, net debt to EBITDA of 1.7 times. They don't really have the balance sheet to fulfill the aspirations that they have for a number of their businesses, including increasing their postpaid market share in the mobile business. So they don't have the balance sheet to do what they want to do. However, they've got some quite attractive assets on their balance sheet that I think parties such as MTN will continue to be interested in. So it's just a matter of whether the boards of the respective companies can, in fact, sit down, hammer out a transaction that makes sense to both boards and indeed to both sets of shareholders, which I have no doubt is probably out there somewhere. Whether they can do it or not remains to be seen. but Telkom as a standalone entity, not particularly attractive from an investor perspective.
And just quickly, Chris, I mean, give it to me straight. Tomorrow, the Saab would have had the data coming out from StatsSA for about 2 days now. They know what's going on ahead of the market. Tomorrow, you expect them to raise interest rates by 75 basis points again?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's a, you know, disappointing day to have a CPI miss, but, you know, CPI missing probably by 20 basis points versus expectations today, both in terms of the headline and the core measures. Juxtapose that with softening global economic data. We had some more weak data out of the US tonight. That's precipitated quite a lot of dollar weakness. The rand's up 1.5% against the dollar. The oil price in rands is indeed down 6% today. But unfortunately, I think given the weight of evidence we've got right now, I would suspect the marginal 100 basis points calls that we saw at the last MPC meeting will be out of the window. But I think we're on track for 75. Tomorrow we'll be reading, I guess, in the US, they'll be reading over their Thanksgiving turkey. They'll be poring over the Fed minutes from the November MPC meeting to see if there's anything they can discern as to a potential Fed taper or at least a slowdown in the rate of rates increases in the US. Maybe we only see 50 basis points in the US in the next meeting. But as a long answer to a short question, I think we go 75 basis points again tomorrow, Mateo.
Tough news, but I expected that. Chris, that's Chris Stewart, portfolio manager at 91, giving us the market lowdown in our commentary today. Of course, we'll, after the news, we'll be giving you a more preview on the central bank's decision on interest rates and the economy. Peter Worthington, the senior economist at APSA, taking us through those numbers and what he expects from the SAR. But for now, it's 6:30. It's time for Eyewitness News.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa CIB. To gain data-driven insights on consumer behavior in African markets, tune in to the Absa Insight Series podcast. That's Africanacity. Absa is an authorized FSP.
Welcome back to The Money Show. If you're worried about interest rates on Thursday, join the club. I am too. Inflation up 7.6% in October. Man, it's getting harder to fill our shopping trolleys, but there's more to worry about. Interest rates coming out tomorrow. Peter Worthington, senior economist at APSA, joining us for this conversation. Peter, welcome to The Money Show. Peter is, of course, in Cape Town. Can you hear me, Peter?
I can hear you very well.
Are
you
there able we go. To hear me? Loud and clear. I thought you ran away because we're all afraid of these hiking interest rates coming up on Thursday. Inflation going up today. The Reserve Bank would have had these numbers for the past 2 or 3 days. They know the data. What do you expect them to do tomorrow? Are we getting another 75 basis points increase?
That's our forecast, certainly. And I think there are several reasons for it beyond this morning's upside surprise in CPI. You know, we're expecting, and I think all the forecasts and indeed the Reserve Bank's own forecasts show core CPI inflation continuing to rise. And with the last two prints that we've had, we're going to find the SARB tomorrow publishing inflation forecasts that are revised to the upside. Secondly, you know, we still have inflation expectations, which are well above the midpoint of the target range. And we still have a negative repo rate. So for all of those reasons, we think the SARB is going to hike, and hike 75 as opposed to 50. And I guess there's a third factor, which is that we're right at this juncture before we go into these illiquid markets over the festive season. And if they think they're going to have to hike anyway, particularly since there are a couple of risk events in there, there's the December FOMC, there's the ANC's elected conference, we think they will be biased to sort of go with the 75 rather than the 50.
I mean, if we look at it, the U.S. Central Bank expected to release those Fed minutes later this evening. And we've always imported these higher interest rates from the U.S. And the U.S. Fed earlier this month saying, look, we're seeing that our inflation is not as bad as it used to be, but we'd like to continue on a hiking cycle, at least until we are comfortable that inflation has peaked. What do you expect our monetary policy stance to be in the next few months?
So I don't think we need to move exactly in lockstep with the Federal Reserve. We started hiking before they did. We are going to hit peak repo rate before they hit peak Fed funds. And then I think ultimately we might actually be able to cut even before they start cutting once they've reached peak Fed funds. We have, as I say, 75 on for tomorrow. We have a forecast of another 50 in January. But to be honest, I think that forecast, there's risk around it. And it will really depend on how the markets, and in particular the Rand, react to the December Fed meeting and to the ANC's elective conference. We've obviously had quite a nice little recovery in the Rand so far. If that extends further, it makes the likelihood of another big rate hike in January somewhat less. But I think, you know, we're going to see sort of, it's not impossible that we could have peak repo at 750 in January. And then I think that they'd just be on hold for a while. And it's possible we could have a little bit smaller peak repo.
What do you think Governor Lesetša Kganyogo will be looking at in terms of headwinds going into next year? We've heard big banks saying we're going to have a global global recession at the beginning of 2023. What other headwinds does the South African SARB face then in terms of our interest rates?
Well, listen, we've got a big one, as I say, that core is continuing to rise, core CPI. And that's the best measure of the underlying sort of price dynamics, underlying price momentum. And we've had a lot of upside surprises in core CPI. If you actually look at them, we've had far more upside surprises over the last year than we've had kind of downside surprises or forecasts that, or results that landed exactly on the forecast. So that's a big thing. They're very focused on inflation at this stage. It's true that there are worries about the global economy tipping into recession, but actually our sort of growth dynamism, rather surprisingly, doesn't look too bad here in South Africa. We had some really strong activity prints for the month of September, despite the fact that we've got sort of pretty intense load shedding and we've seen a big rise in interest rates. So they're going to have to balance sort of the fight against inflation, the need to get inflation expectations back down, anchored at the midpoint of the target range, with the fact that, you know, rate hikes do impact on consumption spending and hence growth. So I'd watch the growth numbers too when they publish tomorrow. But it's that trade-off between sort of growth and inflation as they go forward that I think is going to matter. But they'll prioritize the fight against inflation. But I think we're nearing peak repo. We're almost at a phase where we're going to see the real repo rate in positive territory where they'll feel a lot more comfortable.
Well, Peter, we already said the SARB was ahead of the curve, starting their hiking cycle, I think, in November last year already, and they've kept hiking, but inflation hasn't got down to that band that they like, between 3 and 6%. Do you think they'll get a little bit nervous that inflation is not going down, even though interest rates have remained up in our economy?
No, it takes time for interest rates to have their effect. And in fact, what we're going to see going into next year, into 2023, is that the headline CPI inflation rate is going to fall actually quite sharply in early 2023, such that by the middle of 2023, we'll be back within the target range. The reason it will be falling will be because there are strong base effects working on food and fuel prices. But underneath that, core is continuing to rise. And so I think that that's what they're going to be very focused on. They're going to want to have pretty good confidence that core CPI inflation is going to peak out. Their forecast at the last MPC was that it would peak at 5.5% in the second quarter. They'll probably be revising that up slightly, I think, tomorrow, but we'll just have to see. And I think once they're convinced that their forecast is playing out, once they can feel that core CPI has peaked and is now going to start falling again, then they'll be a little bit more relaxed on the inflation plate.
All right, that was Peter Worthington, senior economist at APSA, giving us a breakdown of what he expects to happen with the South African Reserve Bank, of course, releasing interest rates tomorrow.
702, let's walk the talk.
Streaming countrywide on the 702 app.
Now, after dipping from 42 to 39 in the third quarter, the RMB BR Business Confidence Index slipped to 38 in the final quarter of 2022. The fourth quarter survey covered just over 1,000 senior executives in the country in the building, manufacturing, retail and wholesale and motor trade industries. Joining us for this particular conversation is Sybon Redford, economist at RMB. Sybon, welcome to The Money Show. Firstly, this is still flat confidence, but the numbers aren't really showing a true picture of what's happening in the country.
Well, you know, I think it gives us a good sense that overall something like load shedding is problematic. But yes, given that you know, the survey does look at only really 5 sectors of the economy, it does miss out on other parts of the economy. And also, interestingly enough, with this relatively flat print, it's also actually masking quite big moves for the sectors that are surveyed.
And what are the executives saying, those that you've surveyed in these industries, what are their major concerns about South Africa's business confidence?
That is, I think, the question that we'd all like to know. But, you know, that said, I think it really does come down to load shedding and structural constraints in general. You know, in general, the economy has seen the most intense load shedding we've ever seen in any year this year, with a majority of that having been in the second half of this year, which also ties in with the fact that your business confidence index in the second half of the year has been lower than in the first half of the year. Over and above that, a number of your sectors are experiencing issues with the ports, you know, be it trying to get parts into the country or even, you know, export the goods once ready for sale. You know, then we also have other issues related to Transnet, including, you know, your rail, the reliability of rail. I think the other concern looking ahead is obviously the impact of higher interest rates, not just in South Africa, but around the world on demand. And that it does look like the global economic kind of trend is for slower growth next year, with the possibility of recession in a number of important trading partners for South Africa.
There was also a recovery for building confidence. It recovered all the way to 46 from 29 in the third quarter. What pushed up that particular sector?
So this was actually, this was our good news story. And it is nice to speak about. There are a couple of factors coming into it. In terms of what has been seen during this quarter, it seems that there has been quite a lot of activity in the retail sector, which has, you know, been which has helped kind of buoy confidence in the sector. We have also seen momentum seeming to grow in terms of the reconstruction and rebuild in KwaZulu-Natal following those devastating floods that we saw earlier in the year, that, you know, is likely to continue for a little bit longer and is quite positive. And then looking forward, and this is, I think, going to be the most important, you know, especially when we see, you know, a slow and difficult year next year, but the most important to bear in mind is, given that red tape around embedded generation for companies has eased, and that we are starting to see some progress with respect to the Independent Power Producers Program, that we're going to move from the kind of administrative side of you know, these projects to the actual building side of these projects. And that is going to boost the you know, be a further boost when it does start to the building sector, as well as to fixed investment in the economy.
And as these businesses struggle, obviously we need to worry about the unemployment in the country. Anything from the index that picked up on employment?
It basically, in general, it does seem that there is, concern that employment is going to be weaker as a result of the high level of load shedding. You know, I think that we will see marginal movements. The bigger problem, though, that being the actual level of unemployment in our economy, you know, is going to rely on continued improvement in terms of our, you know, dealing with structural reforms going forward. So, you know, the building sector probably has a positive outlook in terms of employment, but, you know, on the retail and manufacturing side, that's probably not looking quite as rosy. But if we start seeing this infrastructure spend, these infrastructure projects, starting, but also building momentum, that, you know, not only is it going to see employment through their work, but also as they start enabling business more broadly in the economy through an improved structure of the economy.
Let's look at retail now. I mean, we're going into the festive season, usually a big spending period for South Africans, but with a lot of them really cash-strapped because of the tough economy we've had this year, retailers still concerned in terms of business on their front.
Absolutely. Even though it hasn't quite come, it does seem that your retailers are relatively downbeat about prospects for Black Friday and the Christmas season or the festive period in December. And you know, this really does come down to the fact that your goods, you know, consumer goods are seeing a decline in demand. And there are a number of factors contributing to this, which include things like the fact that we are seeing the end of kind of the great home renovation project of the pandemic period, that we, you know, people's wardrobes are now more work ready than they, you know, than they were at the start of the year. But then I think the really significant factors being much higher food and fuel prices. These are necessities, and so with higher prices, people, you know, you're going to see that spend on those is going to crowd out spend on other, you know, other goods, and the higher interest rates. One positive aspect that you don't see reflected in all of this, though, is also that as we are seeing spending patterns return to more normal type patterns, you're also going to see less goods being purchased because, you know, at one stage we could only buy stuff, and people now starting to spend more money on services, restaurants, hotels, so, you know, tourism and going out, movies, entertainment, all of those kind of things, as well as kind of personal services improving. So, you know, retail is probably quite downbeat because it is just getting battered from all sides.
You know, last year, manufacturing was one of the big sectors, contributing 13% to South Africa's GDP, the gross value there at R500 billion. But, you know, the sector heads there, the executives that came through on this survey, not too confident. I mean, the confidence, the index rather, looking at manufacturing, saying confidence is depressingly low at 26, not even close to that 50-point mark.
It's a bit of a perfect storm for manufacturing. The good news is that it hasn't gotten worse relative to the third quarter. So I think those kind of factories that are hit by this high level of load shedding in terms of not being able to produce remain. So we aren't seeing more. But, you know, again, they're paying for those that continue operating during periods of load shedding. They're paying a lot to be able to keep operating due to the cost of fuel. Also, you know, we are seeing our export sales decreasing, so that means our exports, you know, are low. And what's really interesting is kind of this time last year we were hearing a lot about supply chain constraints still, and how that was actually preventing manufacturing from ramping up to the extent it wanted to. And I mean, I think we still see it to some extent in car sales and car production. However, while that might be the case because of supply chain issues and also to some extent port inefficiencies, you know, that demand is now expected to wane because of these, you know, very high prices and because of higher interest rates. You know, there is talk of recessions overseas. It almost feels inevitable that in Europe and the UK that it's going to happen. The question is, what's the case with the US? Are we seeing a soft landing or not? If there's a recession there, that's, you know, really going to have quite a strong impact on demand for manufactured goods. And you know, I think this is what is weighing on the mind of your manufacturers.
And what is your assessment into the next year as RMB? Because given these low numbers, you'd expect that these sectors will continue to struggle, especially knowing that South Africa is struggling to give out consistent electricity supply and also those supply constraints not going away. Our export partners also in trouble in terms of their economies. So, you know, exports are not likely to be quite high. So are you expecting maybe later in the year we're seeing business confidence get around that 50-point mark?
I'm not sure I'm going to quite say around that 50-point mark. The long-term average isn't quite at 50. It would be really nice to see that, though. I think it should improve. I think we should start seeing it, you know, going above 40 and hopefully staying consistently above 40, moving above 45. But, it, you know, the first half of the year, at the very least, is going to feel quite tough. And it really is going to depend on what the outcome is in terms of inflation, in terms of monetary policy. So, you know, does the central bank stop hiking? Does the Fed stop hiking eventually? I mean, they're looking at the interest rates that they haven't seen in a very, very long time. And if not, then, you know, it is going to be a case that global demand is going to drop, and that is going to be negative for us. And I mean, we haven't even spoken about China and COVID and how that's had an impact. So it is going to be a tough year. But I mean, what we must remember, and I mean, interestingly, that lower demand, we're still going to kind of meet it as best as we can, with probably what preventing our growth from you know, really kind of doing anything, even though it is weaker.
Oh, there's so much to talk about, Simon Redford, the economist at RMB. Thank you so much for joining us. So much to unpack in terms of business confidence in the country. But we'll, of course, call you back for another conversation on these numbers.
702
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Streaming on 702.co.za.
The 702 app.
And on DStv channel 856.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa CIB. To gain data-driven insights on consumer behavior in African markets, tune into the Absa Insights Series podcast. That's Africanacity. Absa is an authorized FSP. Well, we're going to be getting into business unusual now with Colin Cullies.
The Money Show.
Business unusual
with Colin Cullies.
Many Taylor Swift fans will miss her 52-day tour after huge demand for tickets and ticket sales glitch left many disappointed. The tour comes on the heels of her record-breaking new album, Midnights. Ticketmaster saying it was cancelling public ticket sales, citing extraordinarily high demands on tickets, systems and insufficient ticket inventory. To talk to us about this is Colin Cullies on Business Unusual. Colin, welcome again. A huge dominance of Ticketmaster, the company still not delivering those tickets for concert fans.
Yeah, in fact, the tour is officially called the Era Tour, but fans, given how much trouble they had, have renamed it the Era Tour. And some of the criticism is justified, and some of the issues with Ticketmaster, you know, they should answer for. But I'm also mindful that some of these problems are a little bit bigger than Ticketmaster and anybody else. And hopefully, if I can run through them with you, perhaps we can come to some understanding of those and maybe even some potential options for improving them. But it covers the sort of things of demand and managing that, the role that bots play. These are automated buying opportunities. Resellers or scalpers, to give them their more common name. Dynamic ticket prices and how we feel about those. And then this monopoly power that you refer to that Ticketmaster has. So let me start with the demand and ask you, would you prefer to buy your ticket outright so you can choose where you sit and how many tickets you want? Or would you say, no, just put me in a lottery and then I know if I get a ticket, I get a ticket. What's your view on that?
I definitely know where I want to know where I'm sitting, especially if I'm paying as much as these concert goers are paying for these tickets.
And you are like most of humanity. The challenge, though, is when everybody wants that specific seat and everybody wants to, you know, select their specific seat, we get this problem with, well, if you've got a finite number of seats, but not a greater amount of demand, things get problematic. And I remember from the 2010 World Cup and most World Cups and big sporting events where they know they've got a limited number of seats, particularly towards the sharp end of the tournament, where everybody wants to go and see the quarterfinals, semifinals, and the final. And there's just no way you can satisfy everybody. Or you have to charge crazy amounts of money, which effectively says, well, most people on the planet will never be able to watch a World Cup game in a stadium. Is what they do is they say, listen, you can put in for a request for up to 4 tickets per match and up to so many matches in the various stages. And then you wait, and they'll tell you at which date they will do the lottery. And if you get an email from them, well done, you got it. Now, you're not going to be sitting, as many Taylor Swift fans were, hours and hours on end, clicking on a website, waiting for it to load. Does it load? Does it say you're waiting? And in this particular case, there were three different sections you had to get to. So first there was an initial login, and then you said, yes, I'm logging in, I'm waiting. Then you go into a waiting room, and then you go into a queue, and then you see the queue countdown, and then finally you can buy the tickets. And for many people, well, let me say many people, certainly too many people, even if they made it all the way through those stages, when it came to actually buying the ticket, they would have got the, sorry, ticket sold out, or the ticket you've requested is no longer available, making you deeply unhappy. To use another World Cup comparison, at the beginning of that tournament, there are, you know, at least 32 countries all think they got a shot of winning the world's greatest prize. By the end of it, there are 31 countries that think this is the worst thing ever because the team
they've lost.
And this is the kind of catch with one of these things. And Ticketmaster themselves, and I'm quoting their numbers, I haven't seen any other verifications or validations for it, but they said in this first pre-sale amount, which was supposed to go to Taylor Swift fans, you're supposed to already have registered to say, I love Taylor Swift. There was 1.5 million tickets made available for that sale of the 2.5 million that were going to be made available. They say they received 14 million different people looking to log in to try and buy a ticket.
This is crazy.
Some people said, yeah, that is crazy. And in fact, at one point they said, well, were that the case, if there were actually 14 million people that wanted to attend Taylor Swift concerts at the venues they had available, so far this is the US tour dates that were announced, then Taylor Swift would have to perform every single night for the next 2.5 years.
In 900 stadiums.
Certainly 900 events. That would be unfair to expect any artist to be able to do that. I mean, she'd make an absolute fortune, but she'd probably, well, I doubt she could complete it. And this is where you have to balance then. So if you can't satisfy everybody, how do you find a fair way to satisfy as many people as possible? Now, that's not to say that computers can't handle the demand. I don't know if you've come across Singles Day. I mean, South Africa is about to do Black Friday, but Singles Day puts Black Friday in the shade.
Touche.
Have you come across it?
Yes, I think it's a Chinese phenomenon, isn't it?
Absolutely. So Singles Day was invented kind of because China has this sort of slightly skewed population where there's a lot more males than females. And so there's a lot of, you know, males that aren't necessarily in relationships. And marketers with an eye for an opportunity say, you know what, on the 11th of November, so 1111, have you buy yourself something for yourself? So it's not Valentine's, you buy something for your partner, or any of those other days. On Singles Day, you buy something for yourself. And they have effectively big discounts, loads and loads of brands. And effectively 900 million people took part last year. Alibaba was a little quieter about how well it went this year, possibly because it didn't have the same amazing growth and possibly was at least the same or a little worse. But even so, if they managed to get anywhere near 900 million people in 24 hours taking part to looking to buy something, that still makes Taylor Swift's little 1.5 million, even 2.5 million, like big deal. You know, that's nothing. But the difference is when you've got 900 million people over 24 hours going on to buy something, they're buying a lot of different products on a bunch of different websites. It's not just Alibaba that does this, although they do the lion's share of it. Whereas for the Taylor Swift concerts, you've got only that ticket and you've got a whole bunch of people wanting to buy the same ticket before it sells out. And manage that with a computer is really quite challenging. Because you can't sell a ticket twice. If you do, you've got bigger problems as a promoter. So you have to give, you know, all this like, well, you just wait until finally let one person through. It's okay. Which seat do you want? I want that seat. You've got the next 3 minutes to make sure you give me a credit card, to make sure the credit card is valid so you can actually purchase it. Then I give it to you. Then I have to remove it from the pool, let the next guy in. And if he wants the same ticket, say, sorry, it's gone. Now, what do you do with them? Do you put them back in the back of the queue? Do you say, now choose another ticket? And then they waste time choosing another ticket. It's a mess.
But so here's my thing, Colin. In terms of Ticketmaster, in 2010, it merged, of course, with Live Nation, and we were all expecting this huge system overhaul that's going to have all the fans satisfied with their services. Why has it not worked out, especially in terms of systems and infrastructure? This is Taylor Swift, one of the biggest artists and chart-topping artists in the world. Surely you're expecting a swarm of people to come through and try to get those tickets.
Well, in part because they don't want it to. When you have this level of demand, you know that the after sales or the resales
are much higher.
Correct. So this kind of bad publicity is good publicity. And so let's touch on those resellers. Their opportunity now is to say everybody really wants a ticket more than they've ever wanted a ticket before. And so perhaps those ticket prices range between, well, it was $50 to about $500. So in South African terms, sort of, well, we'll be at about 900 Rand up to about 8,000 Rand. The resale tickets start at 8,000 Rand that I saw on Vidigogo and some of these other ones. When I went onto the Ticketmaster reseller prices, they somebody said there are no tickets available at the moment. But they went up to an eye-watering 320,000 Rand for one of the front row tickets at one of the first concerts that's taking place. 300,000 rand for a ticket that was marked at 8,000 rand is a crazy big markup.
Look, maybe I don't get it, Colin. You know, I'm not a Taylor Swift fan, but 300,000, would this be like a VIP package at this particular concert?
Yeah, it is one of those sort of very close to the front seats. But again, those resellers will put that ticket available for that price to get me to tell you that number so that other people will repeat that number to make people think that the prices of 8,000 rand is actually not that bad. When in fact, it is crazy. It should not be 8,000 rand. Your front row seats should be 8,000 rand. But you see, this is how the whole psychology skews into how these resellers work. Now, Ticketmaster in South Africa, as far as I can tell, and from their website, they said they do not allow for tickets to be resold in South Africa. You cannot pre-buy them for putting them into giveaways, nor can you use them and package them up to say, hey, I've got this VIP package and you get a ticket to this concert and whatever else, which I don't think is a bad thing, but I can't imagine that it'll be the way they keep it. Because not doing so obviously makes it kind of difficult. As radio broadcasters and many other media companies, you typically would say, well, let's go and get some of those tickets, give away to our listeners, etc. That makes for good sense. Now, it's not to say it can't be done, but it'll have to be done with a promoter rather than you going online and buying tickets. And it also means that you can't resell that ticket. Now, that's also a challenge. If you bought a ticket and you were planning to attend something, you probably did spend a fair bit of money for it. Do you think it's fair that you don't get to resell it, or you couldn't sell it to somebody else and have them use your ticket? Do you say, well, I bought the ticket, I can't go anymore, I'm going to just rip it up and take the loss? What's your view on that?
How would they know that? I mean, when you go to a concert, yes, you might have some form of identification, but you just scan the ticket and you walk through. I mean, how would you know if somebody has a ticket that's been resold to them?
Well, more and more, the tickets have got barcodes, and the barcodes are allocated to a person, and they'll say, listen, you come through there, show me your ID, prove that this is you. In other markets, that's been done as much as a safety control, where people have sort of been concerned that when you get big groups of people together, somebody might try and do something, terrorist attacks, etc. So that's why the added security is added on. But for the regular consumer, he says, well, you know what, I'm going to give it to a friend, have them go. And the friend gets there and he says, oh, this isn't going to work. In fact, there was a recent issue with a promotion that DSTV had. And a lot of people rocked up because somebody took a ticket, cloned what the little access code would be, and pretended they were selling them online. So by having somebody with a ticket that isn't valid, you can have a whole bunch of people arriving thinking they've got valid tickets, and they can't get in. And then it's hard for you to say, well, who can and who can't come in if you don't have it actually assigned to a person. And so that's, again, in principle, it sounds nice if everybody just be, responsible. But when they're not, it all goes pear-shaped. And so here we have it. And now in the US and many other markets that Ticketmaster operates, the reseller part is thing they advocate. In fact, they got done a couple of years ago. Undercover news agency went in and found out that actually actively looking to have people become resellers. Again, when you have a reseller, they're buying those initial tickets. They're creating demand for later on. They're also giving the promoters the sort of, phew, we've managed to sell the first 1,000, 2,000 tickets for a particular event. That means they've got cash in the bank. They're not going to go bust. And if you can get them to drive that demand and push the prices up later, well, then, again, there's going to be more people saying, wow, the tickets are selling out really fast. Let's make sure we get ours now and move on from there. But the flip side of that is, okay, take out the resellers. Ticketmaster also offers this notion of dynamic pricing.
Yeah.
Now, that is to say, would you prepare to go to a concert if the tickets were sold the way an airline seat is done? And they are doing it. And that's to say, if there's a lot of people that want to go initially, then the $50 ticket becomes a $100 ticket. And before you know it, your $100 ticket, and you were planning for you and five friends to go along, but that one guy was hassling you to tell you which day he wanted to go, and, well, not which day, but, can he go, can't he go? So you want to get the final numbers in. You got to make the final booking, and now the tickets have all doubled in price. Now the whole group of you have had to pay double because one guy decided to take his time and the ticket prices have changed. That's also a bit of a problem. The plus, though, is that at least the artists in this case, they'll make that money. So if this scalper who has got his 320,000 rand ticket and he manages to sell it, well, the 8,000 rand to 300,000 rand, that's the difference, and he makes all that money. With a dynamically priced ticket, the promoters will get some of their money, but most of it will go to the artists. So that's the advantage or potential of saying that's where you go. Now, I know you're about to discuss Black Friday and those elements, in which case I must mention to you then bots. Because if I had to ask you, is it fair?
Oh, those dreaded bots.
With dreaded bots, or if I ask you, is it fair for a friend or a family member to buy a ticket on your behalf?
It's fair. I think it's fair. If I can't do it at that particular time.
So what if your friend or family member happens to be a machine?
Even better, I'll get the tickets. I'll definitely get the tickets.
And that's what motivates people. So, a bot can operate like dozens, if not hundreds of people, and with multiple accounts, it can absolutely just hit that machine all the time and guarantee you're going to get what you want. So there is some value in saying, well, why not have a bot? And Black Friday has a lot of these bots that go and look for the deal, wait for the best price, and help you get those deals you want. But of course, they also limit other people's ability to do that. So there's a lot more stuff. I'll leave it online. I'm mindful we've got a time constraint. So let me give you a couple of solutions. If there was more transparency about the cost and availability of tickets, then at least you'd be able to balance that demand and let people know ahead of time, look, there are only going to be 2.5 million tickets. 1.5 million of you already fans. Start tempering your potential need for this. Start pre-sales in a different kind of way. Sell them in smaller batches, which they sometimes do anyway, to get demand up. That would be one option. Mix up lottery tickets versus buy your ticket outright. So those who want to pay at a low price, you go in a lottery. If you want to stump up and pay top dollar, by all means, pick your seat. But there's only going to be some of them, or you're going to have to pay a lot. I would say remove reselling, but allow for the resale for those who can't attend. Big sporting tournaments, like I know the tennis tournaments, they actually limit that you can only buy from the tournament itself. And if you can't go, you give the ticket back to them and they will sell it for you. If nobody takes it, sorry, you lost your money. But if somebody does want to take it, they will return the money to you. The ticket gets reallocated for somebody and that's all good. That's kind of good. You need to limit the amount of bots that are in the mix. Some of them might not be bad, but that's the notification to say, just jump in the queue and we'll let you know when it's your turn to buy. That'll be useful. But that's the extent of it. From a consumer side using bots, I think that's going to be kind of bad. And then the biggest one, artists simply need a better way to balance where their revenue comes from. It used to be a mix of revenue got from music sales, but that's kind of fallen through because streaming revenue is nothing. They rely on the concerts to make the money. And if that's so much heavily influenced over there, and then you add on top of that, as you said, Live Nation buying Ticketmaster, and now they own half of the venues where they are, you effectively got no option if you want to be an artist and know that you can have a well-run event and have people be safe when they're there and trust that when they buy a ticket, they're going to get access to the thing, that you will have this monopoly forming. And so all of this stuff comes together to say it's a way more complex than we thought. And for those who did manage to get tickets, I hope they enjoy their concerts in 2023.
Well, brilliant. That's Colin Cullis, of course, giving us Business Unusual, looking at the complicated world of buying tickets and selling tickets. Of course, we'll all be concert goers over this festive season trying to get to our favorite events. My advice, be first in line. And if you can't, try get a bot.
The Money Show.
Consumer Ninja.
Time for Consumer Ninja now, and we're 2 days away from Black Friday, of course, and we're going to get a Black Friday from a consumer's point of view with Kobus Ekstein, Nielsen IQ Sub-Saharan Africa Analytics Director. Your particular survey looked at how Black Friday is set to surpass Christmas sales. Just give us some of those numbers and why this is happening.
Yeah, absolutely. Good evening. Like you say, Black Friday is a massive event for the FMCG industry. So at Nielsen IQ, we're in a unique and fortunate position to have a very holistic coverage of the FMCG market. So we're always excited when we get to analyze events like this. And so this year's report, we unpacked over 300 categories that we looked at. And yes, Black Friday continues to bring in a bumper sales for the industry. In fact, it grew its lead over the historical biggest time of the year, your December month-in period, from 2% bigger in 2020 to 6% last year in 2021. That's a big jump in 1 year for the total basket. And we're talking well over 8 billion rand of sale happening during the week. And just over half of that, and just over 4 billion, is happening at a discounted price. You know, so enormous amount of volume in a single week. In fact, we also compared it to your normal month-end promotional period that we're all familiar with. And we see that it's 23% higher than your average month-end period. So huge amount of sales. That's why there's such a big buzz in the industry. And it's something that I guess is here to stay.
Do you think we all get caught up in this buzz of Black Friday? I mean, that's what's driving up the sales. The fact that your neighbor, your friend, everyone is talking about it. And even though you don't want to participate, you end up going, what's discounted that I can get and feel part of this whole Black Friday frenzy?
Yeah, that's a brilliant question. I think can probably talk about this for days. But look, there is a frenzy, of course. You know, marketing is a very powerful tool and it's there for a reason, right? But you know, I'm a glass half full guy, so I do believe that, you know, ultimately there's some great deals for consumers.
For
right?
Sure.
So if you keep your wits about you, you've got a plan, you've got a budget, you stick to it, you know, there is definitely relief for the pressured consumers that we currently have in South Africa. So I think as long as you go about it sensibly and you make sure you're buying the right type of products, which you can maybe unpack in a couple of minutes, but, you know, if you're buying the right type of products, things you were going to use anyway, then I think there's definitely benefit for the consumer end of the day.
I was saying to a friend of mine, I don't think this Black Friday has been promoted like previous years. And I think maybe I'm feeling like that because it's been a different year economically. If you look at, you know, the cost of living crisis that we're all going through after the Russia-Ukraine war, there's not a lot to spend in terms of budget. So do you think this particular Black Friday will still do well?
Yeah, that's a great question again. I mean, I think when we look at the trend, you know, every year Black Friday just continues to grow and grow. And despite all of the pressures that you're talking about, you know, there's this term, you know, promo, FOMO consumers that we have in South Africa, right? You know, South Africans just love a good deal. In fact, you know, the country ranks consistently in the top five most price-sensitive countries that Nielsen IQ measures globally. We also did a consumer sentiment just the other day, and 86% of consumers claim that they expect prices to be going up in the next 6 months. You know, so if you throw all of this in the mix, you know, with inflation, cost of living going up, fuel, electricity, etc., then, you know, you've got a recipe where I feel like Black Friday and the deals that it offers for the smart shopper essentially gives them opportunity to alleviate some of that pressure, right? You know, another thing that you can maybe think of in South Africa, you know, we've got very strong stockpiles, buying groups, neighbor sharing, etc. So, you know, if you bring that kind of group buying into it, and like I mentioned, you keep your wits about you, you're buying shelf-stable, long-lasting products that you were going to use anyway, then yes, I think it's a great deal and there's benefit there.
And looking at those stock fails, I mean, those are the ones that have been driving the shopping period over the festive season for Christmas and New Year. Are you seeing a trend maybe where a lot of stock fails are withdrawing the money earlier and looking for Black Friday specials instead?
Yeah, good point. I think one of the key, I mean, it's tough to really nail that down, but one of the key elements is, for example, the lead that Black Friday has taken over December, growing that lead from 2% to 6% in just 1 year. I think that definitely already indicates potentially that some money is moving or being pulled forward from December into November. When we looked at some of the particular brands and categories that were doing well in Black Friday compared to the Christmas season, we see things like, you know, all of your dishwashing liquids, your creamers, your instant coffees, edible oils, etc. So these are all long-lasting, shelf-stable products, you know, and we saw them growing or selling between 100% to 500% more during Black Friday than Christmas. While on the flip side, items that are doing fantastically well during Christmas are things like your biscuits, your fruits, jellies, your ice creams, your desserts and pudding. So I definitely think it's a different basket that's actually being exploited or used or being bought by consumers during these two periods. So I think the industry will definitely cater towards that, and the type of promotions and discounts that you'll be getting will be speaking to that kind of lens.
That's actually another point that I wasn't thinking about, XTN, that you were talking about, Corbis, is that because we're in a tough economy, people always look to bulk buy products because they feel they're getting a discount from getting a lot of them at the same time. And fast-moving consumer goods, especially those that are non-perishable, are always very, very popular. So are you seeing the trend going in terms of Black Friday for people going for those type of products so that maybe early into next year, January, February, March, they still have those products in stock and they don't have to spend much in the beginning of the year?
I think so, right? I mean, obviously, we're all human and we've all got our weak spots. You know, when you're passing the aisle, you're grabbing maybe a chocolate or ice cream or something as well. But, you know, the reality is the bulk of sales that you're getting a good deal from would sit in that kind of, you know, your day-to-day shopping items. I think that's where you want to be spending your money during Black Friday because you're getting a good deal. You're going to use it anyway. You know, maybe this year, you know, close your eyes when you're walking past a brand new TV because the one at home is still fine, and rather focus your spend on things that can really move the dial for your monthly budget. It can help you kind of alleviate some of that wallet pressure.
And which products do you think will be more discounted this time around by Friday?
Yeah, I mean, when we looked at just last year's result as a way of indication of the types of categories and brands that really invest during this period, you know, it's your ready-to-eat breakfast cereals, your dishwashing liquid, even things like whiskey and gin, we're seeing in there, you know, upwards of 80, almost touching 90% of the volume that sold through till last year and Black Friday of these categories was at the discounted price. Obviously, that being said, you know, these guys are discounting that deep and getting this massive volume uplift. There's obviously also a flip side, you know, to it. When we looked at that volume importance to these categories' total annual sales, some of them were seeing up to 22%.
That it can take you. So coming to Joburg was really about exploring.
I didn't come from much, but an education would really open a door for me. And what I did within those doors,